This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Friday, 1st of October, 2021, a very ugly day for markets yesterday as the U.S., particularly late in the session, dipping and closing right near the lows and actually slightly beyond them, depending on where you're looking on the various averages. Below that 100-day moving average, which seemed to support at the bottom the prior time and was following through in Asia overnight. I don't know what, to what degree that is the dysfunction in U.S. Congress not passing or not even voting on the infrastructure bill, obviously because the votes were not there. They will supposedly be trying again today to vote on this bill, but there's the standoff between progressives and moderates on whether to link the bigger bill, the moderates wanting a smaller social and climate spending bill, and the progressives refusing to vote on the smaller infrastructure bill unless they get the full-sized social bill. So that standoff, some worry there on the potential for a fiscal cliff next year in the U.S. But let's get back to the market. I don't know who wants to jump in here first, but let's look at this where we are. We're at, you can see on slide two, we've closed right near the lows, 4,300 area. What are the next levels? I put up a basic extension. The 100% extension would be 4,226. The 61.8 or 161.8% extension would be all the way down below 4,100. And the 200-day moving average, you can see there, that line coming in just above 4,100. And, you know, Peter, you and I were talking about when markets get like this, I mean, look at the trading ranges you have over the last, let's call it 10 days. It's either or. Either we have a semi-crash or a very extensive, further reach to the downside, or we bounce with equal vehemence. There seems to be no in-between. When we sort of enter the event horizon, you will, volatility-wise, into these market episodes. So we need to, for folks to respect, I guess that's the main message, the potential for volatility here.
Yeah, I agree with that binary outcome. The VIX is above 23, and you can see the curve is really steepening in the front end. So in an ugly scenario today could be if the power energy markets go even higher, and you suddenly see the VIX curve flip, and we're going into the Friday, and then suddenly you have this very, you know, very intensive sell-off. I don't want to spend too much time on the themes because we also have Steen Jacobsen on our podcast today to take us through his opinion. But before we go to you, Steen, I just want to highlight two things on equities. So one thing, and that's maybe also a little bit color from your side, John, because if you look at it in a broader perspective, the NASDAQ 100 futures on slide three on a monthly chart, I mean, I don't portray to be the technical expert of this world, but to me, it looks very ugly, that setup.
And engulfing,
exactly, and the September we have had. And to me, it seems like the 14,000 level in the NASDAQ 100 is the clear next stop here, because that was the big local tops back from April. So I'll just that's just a cautious note. And on slide four, the rally that we talked so much about in this podcast, you know, the rally in the MSCI world was drawdowns less than 5%. That stopped yesterday. And we're up more than 80% since the lows in March last year. And my takeaway is what driving the dynamics besides the marginal cost of energy, which is just exploding, is also the fact that people are sitting on such high gains that are just so outrageous relative to what you could expect over 18 months, that I think a lot of people will run for the exit and take those gains. So I think that makes very toxic or very, very forceful in the dynamics. And I've put in a lot of charts. I've done an OLE, I would say. You always put all these charts. I've done the same thing here, just to square things. So we have the highest equity duration in more than two decades across all the big equity indices. We have a record high profit margin. We have marginal cost of equity that is just simply exploding, almost all-time highs in the Bloomberg Spot Index. And then you have equity valuations at an all-time high in the US and the MSCI world. And we've just flipped on the risk switch. So if you square all that together, I think we have a pretty crazy cocktail, to say the least. All I wanted to say.
Yeah, and I want to get to you, Steen, in a second. But just following up very briefly on what you said, Peter, and I find it very interesting on the equity themes overview there on slide two, and I don't want to dwell on what the reason is, but you see some of the most speculative sectors there showing gains yesterday. I just find that very, very curious and want to see how that sorts out in coming days. what's holding up some of the most speculative sectors that rolled over badly at the beginning of the year, even as the market was continuing to stabilize and charge higher. Stane, what is your perspective there on Peter, one of Peter's, I think, key points, that is that, and your couple of decades plus of experience in the markets, very extensive variety of markets you witnessed, which I think a lot of traders have not, in those that have only been in the market for 5-10 years, this psychology around crazy gains, and then what happens when you start to see these crazy gains and portfolio sense eroding suddenly?
Yeah, so what Peter really says to us is that there's been an outsized upside to equity long since the COVID-19 crisis started. And I think what the investors and the listener needs to realize that you were never supposed to get this kind of return. An average regression sort of return expected from equity is, including dividends and buybacks, somewhere around 7-8%. So you can say 14% is roughly what you should have had. And now you're talking about gains of, in most cases, over 50 and over 100. So those gains was entirely given to you on a free ticket from fiscal expansion, increase in the lower K in terms of transfer, the single biggest transfer of income to the low income categories. And again, a liquidity provision in particularly in first half of this year, never seen in the history of modern finance. So everything being equal, the conservative way to play this would be to look at what was your portfolio value on the 1st of January, 2020, and then reduce the exposure to that, because that free for all gift you were given by the policymakers is not to be repeated. And what has actually happened in this process is that instead of giving you a stream of income from being long equity, they were fast forwarding all of those stream, adding them up and giving them in terms of the increase in value. That's number one. Number two, to circle back to what sort of creating this mini crisis right now. I think the headline from this winter will be we have an energy crisis. And as you unfortunately was alluding to, I'm old enough to have been around in 1973 when we had coffee Sundays in Denmark. And I think the crisis in energy this winter will be as big, if not bigger in relative terms in the impact on eroding disposable income. And that gives me one central point that people need to understand why the energy and the energy price is such an important determiner of what will happen in the future. If we were to be given one optionality of saving the world by doing one thing, the thing we should choose was to reduce the marginal cost of energy to zero. At the marginal cost of zero, productivity would be the highest in history. Why? Because that will give us the ability to desalinate water, vertical farming, computer powers, harvesting, all of the energy intensive processes that we have, all the experiments, all of the research, which right now is to some extent being held back by the cost of energy. So the way to set the world free, the way to solve for the climate change is actually to get the marginal cost of energy down to zero. Okay, so we now, as a premise, say low energy prices is good. It's good for productivity. What is happening right now, and which Ole will address in a minute, is that the energy constraints is now so high, the elasticity of the supply is so big that we have the highest energy prices relatively to disposable income, in particular the lower K. So in other words, we are looking into a winter and a early start to 2022, which is non-productive, even more unproductive than the one that's been given to us by this monetary policy, which most academic paper now realize is actually growing the inequality gap. But most concerning, of course, and what people need to understand is that there is no monetary policy. There is no additional liquidity provision that can solve for the issue, which is in all this commodity complex, because simply the ability to ramp up production, ramp up investments is very, very difficult on its own. The marginal cost of doing that because of ESG and all the compliance that needs to be with the environmental movement means that the cost is somewhere between 16 and 20%, if at all accessible for these people. So in short, energy going up is a massive tax to the lower income, eroding of disposable income, which is nullifying all of the transfer that we've seen due to COVID-19, creating a situation where government will have to do fiscal stimulus, and that fiscal stimulus, by the definition of what we talk about endlessly, which is that the physical world is too small simply for all of the policy choice we have in the world.
Yeah, and that stimulus aimed towards keeping demand up has been what has created some of this, rather than looking at perhaps to the supply side, which now is what needs to probably be stimulated here. But let's go over to your space, Ulla, because the energy is seizing the spotlight, particularly in Europe with the natural gas situation, and even in other commodities, which you've been highlighting as well. And then this morning, I'm seeing a Bloomberg article that silicon, which is a key industrial material for everything from semiconductors themselves to all kinds of metals, solar panels, car parts, et cetera, up some 300% from just 2 months ago. This price rise associated with further power disruptions in China, who is the key producer here. But take us through what you have to say on the latest on the fuel crunch.
Well, it's all about China, John. Slide 7, just highlighting the performance across the commodity space in September. We see this phenomenal rally we had in energy. Just to note that you can see the energy sector is up just shy of 20%, but that index does not include gas, power, and coal, which has obviously been on a tear this past month. I think the news we headlined that broke yesterday from China, basically the government has ordered top energy firms to secure supplies at all costs, really just brings home what the situation we're potentially facing into the winter. And we're going to have a global competition for fuel products, for coal, for gas. Oil is going to be the substitute for those who cannot afford gas, and that will keep oil price support as well. Just giving a reflection of the recent surge in gas, both in Asia and Europe, the cost of gas now in oil equivalent barrels is approaching $200. Remember, Brent is still trading below $80. It is a phenomenal rise. And as Steen mentioned, we've just had this phenomenal boost to in liquidity across the world, provided by governments and central bank. A lot of that has led to this surge in consumer spending. A lot of that spending has gone to Asia, to China. Their production has ramped up in order to meet that demand. Their electricity demand is up 16%. Just try to work out how many millions of tons of coal and gas that is required just to increase production by that. That basically means that they are running low on inventories as we head into the winter. And that's really what is a concern. And for the overall commodity space, it is also from the opposite direction. We could see some of the metals come under pressure in the short term because power outages and the curbing of production or reduced production in China could have an impact on demand for some of these metals in the short term, at least. So copper is challenging. Once again, that key area of support at $4, you can see that on slide 8. And at the same time, I just still reserve the right to be bullish on gold because this inflation is not going to go away to overnight. It's going to stick around. And I think we've seen sign of this week where we had the dollar surging higher. We've had bond yields moving higher as well. Gold has actually done reasonably well. Silver hasn't because it's an industrial metal, so it dropped early in the week. But gold has actually been hanging in there quite well, considering what's happening elsewhere. And I think that is the slow realization that there are other forces at play right now than both the dollar and nominal yields, and that is the inflationary pressure that is growing.
All right, and that really begs the question in some ways as we look at the backdrop here. How are investors meant to hedge themselves in this environment, or those looking for volatility to expand, what to do? And I was just pulling up some VIX curves or VIX, what the VIX is doing right now and the forward VIX curve. And I was actually quite interested to see that this the VIX yesterday, as we closed near the lows of the intraday spike previously, was only up around 23 and actually slightly below where it was from the original spike. So I guess the surprise of the original spike is one of the reasons the VIX exceeded there. But looking at the forward curve, it hasn't shifted that much. So the price of insurance has not gone up that much. So a month ago, when markets were quite calm, we had a curve that topped out around 24 on the VIX 6 months from now, instead of now 20 closing on 26. So we still have actually an upward sloping VIX curve. Steen, your thoughts on risk reduction is obviously one approach here, simply reducing exposure in aggregate. But in terms of hedging in the equity market and general, what are your perspectives now that we've sort of reached this point where we're talking about these binary risks and tremendous volatility, is even if it's we don't know the direction that tremendous volatility is almost a given.
Yeah, so in the 100-year portfolio we operate with a 5% volatility allocation. In the mid curve, I think for those who are able to access and use ETFs, they should definitely have a 5% hedge, because volatility is the only asset that actually will make you money as the market becomes more volatile. The second part, which I allow Peter to elaborate on in a second, of course, is that Peter did a great analysis of some of the trading companies in Europe. So all of the sort of the active players who benefit from increasing volatility, and that's done it stunningly well. I think, if it's not mistaken, I think the Peter's basket in those trading companies are up about 22-23% of the year. So if you are one of these people who do not want to be long volatility, at the bare minimum, do look at Peter's basket on that. And maybe, Peter, you want to elaborate on how that works.
So it's that's a basket on financial trading firms. You can find that actually on slide two, where we have the theme baskets, but they are in the trading platform, and we have an appendix in the end of the slide deck. And I agree with the assessment on the financial trading industry, because it's that part of the industry is naturally long volatility. You can become even more specific. I wrote a month ago about hedging with market makers, and I specifically highlighted the two only available publicly listed market makers in the world, Flow Traders here in Europe, traded on the Amsterdam Exchange. It is the largest, I think, market maker in ETFs, but they're broadening out into other areas of the financial ecosystem. And they have Virtue Financial, which I think is number one and number two in terms of financial market making across the entire space, from fixed income, equities, commodities, currencies, what have you. And I just looked at Flow Traders. So on a day-to-day, they are up 1.5%, while Europe is bleeding almost 2% in Spain and 1.5% in DAX. So you get the sense that market makers are long naturally volatility.
Yeah, and then I would argue as well, you can look across asset classes, and including FX, where volatilities, to my mind, are still quite low given what's going on in the background here. You can see the 3-month implied volatility index, which is a broader one, includes the likes of Eurodollar, et cetera. I put that up on slide 5. You can have a look at that. Dollar yen and yen cross volatility has picked up quite notably, and you can see why if you look at a chart like sterling yen on slide 6, and I'm showing you the broader performance here. The yen, I think part of the reason there's been a bit of discombobulation in the FX space, if you will, is that we originally were seeing the impact of these spiking U.S. Treasury yields until a couple of days ago, which tend to drive yen downside. But if we get into a proper global risk off cycle with yields stabilizing to falling while the focus is on just risky assets per se, and that starts to include EMs, where I think there's a lot of Japanese carry trading activity, suddenly the yen becomes this safe haven when those yields are stable and you otherwise have risk off. So look at that sterling yen chart, quite a remarkable head and shoulders style formation. Arguably the neckline is a bit indistinct. It doesn't really matter. I think the interesting thing is that it's still relatively inexpensive for those looking for a hedge in the FX space, whether that's dollar upside, yen upside, maybe even to a degree Swiss franc upside, which we've seen a bit of here recently, although the difficulty there is you're always fighting the S&B at some point. And that some point is arriving quickly as Euro Swiss has dropped below 108. Okay. What are your thoughts, Stane, on what the response here is? There a response level? I mean, we've talked a lot about and some of the internal meetings, and I think even here on the podcast, about the risk of a stagflationary style scenario, which we're seeing here. Weak real growth as inflation proves non-transitory means that, you know, the monetary policy becomes less relevant, and then fiscal policy even becomes more difficult because you stimulate and that just feeds straight into prices going higher. What is the response function here if we do, continue lower? Let's say we have a proper teetering on the edge of a bear market at some point here in the coming days to weeks. And how do you think the market reacts relative to the, for example, the pandemic cycle?
So classically, since 1998, with the LTCM and the Greenspan introduction of the put on the market from the Federal Reserve, what we've seen is liquidity has always been the first sort of policy response function that was being used. The problem right now is that everybody in the world, including the central bank and themselves, realize that additional liquidity will only do two things. It will increase the inequality in society, which is becoming a clear political issue. I mean, as we speak today, Graz in Austria turned communistic. Berlin was just about to take the property laws away. And in Copenhagen, we're going to see that the Communist Party is probably going to beat the SPD party in elections. So the undertone here is that social inequality is unacceptable. And that means that the threshold for central banks to actually intervene and add liquidity to increase. It does not, however, say that they're not going to do it. I'm just saying that it's not going to be enough that the market's down 5, 6, 7% if it's orderly. It is not now even not going to be enough if it's 10%, again, if it's relatively orderly. If there's disruption of liquidity in terms of interbank trading and the likes, yes, they will intervene. But the threshold for liquidity provision is very small. And that leaves the fiscal response, which certainly is at the forefront right now in the U.S. because, as you said, the bill that was voted on, the small bill of the $500 billion yesterday, was retracted, apparently, according to the White House, who's, and sorry the pun, but they are always lying anyway, but they said they are closer than ever to striking a deal. But the ability actually for U.S. to enable this infrastructure fiscal boost seems very, very difficult. Of course, to some extent, that has to do with the 2022 midterm election, but certainly the political apparatus in the US is under huge constraints from this political battle. But the fiscal response will be the one that we met, and that will just make Ole's business worse, and they will hit Peter's asset classes, because what it's going to do is to make the fiscal world, again, even smaller relatively to what is needed. And it's going to be under the headline and the label of ESG with the big focus on the E side of that. And that just simply means that we are pushing on a string. We are making sure that things get worse. But that is the policy front. The irony, of course, being neither liquidity provision or even fiscal response is going to do anything for the winter of 21-22. So what needs to be done is it's more productivity related plans to do and build capacity in base loads electricity. It is to make sure when the windmills is experiencing high winds like we had over the last week, they actually use the utility from that. But in right now, what's happening is that they close down the windmills because they're generating too much relative electricity relative to the network grid that is in operation. And then on top of it, you have the labor market, 100,000 drivers in the UK missing. In the rest of Europe, because of the close down of COVID, you can't even educate or get the licenses for the big driving license because it's been basically closed down. And as these things are done by government agencies, it's very slow to respond and very slow to actually make a preparation for what is needed. So we are looking into some ugly non-working responses, but the responses will be there, delayed in terms of liquidity and immediate in terms of fiscal responses, but always under the name of ESG.
All right. And I think we should close on just a general note of caution, believing that the trader should step back and wait to see what happens next, unless you're in risk reduction mode, because we do highlight the risk of extreme volatility here, even semi-risk of crash because of the way these moves unfold once you get inside the event horizon. But I guess it's worth highlighting a couple of macro calendar points. We have the flash CPI out of Eurozone for September up this morning, PCE inflation, the Fed's preferred measure, up later this afternoon, and then the ISM manufacturing. And next week, Australian RBA meeting and RBNZ meeting from New Zealand. Interesting there because of where markets are, if they're going into a hiking cycle, I'm not sure it'll affect their decision to do so after they were derailed last time by the COVID outbreak in New Zealand. And then, of course, we have the first of the more interesting unemployment reports or employment reports out of the U.S. because early September was when a lot of these pandemic-linked benefits rolled off, and to what degree workers are shifting their horizons and looking for these huge numbers of jobs, job openings, and deciding to re-enter the workforce if they are qualified for these open positions. So interesting setup for the September, October, November U.S. employment reports for sure on that note. So again, helmets on, stay careful out there, have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week to see where things stand with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.